I love it the best. It's where you walk me through my day and lay me through my nights. You ride me like a wave to beach of morning lights. We'll kick back with little tides flow with the sea, the sand, the earth and the land, you and I.
Welcome to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. No intro today because I still have to make one. Sorry, I will get back to you on that. I promise sometime soon. So today we have two guests. Our main guest is Michael Clarkson. He is the author of The Poltergeist Phenomenon, an in-depth investigation into floating beds, smashing glass, and other unexplained disturbances. Ooh. But before we start our interview, we are going to speak with Suzanne. She is from the Coast Salish Nation. Hello, Suzanne.
Hi.
Hi, welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us. So you have a march for the elimination of racism coming up.
That's right. I just quickly to correct, I'm actually a member of No One's Illegal Vancouver here on unceded Coast Salish territory, and I'm not actually from the Coast Salish.
Oh, thanks for clarifying.
No worries. There will be a community march against racism on March 20th. And it's to, first of all, March 21st is the International Day of the Elimination of Racism. And it commemorates the 1960 Sharpeville massacre in South Africa. 67 people were killed by police who opened fire on people protesting the apartheid passbook law. And so it's become the International Day of the Elimination of Racism. And No One Is Illegal will be holding a march on the 20th, like I said before, starting at 2 o'clock at Waterfront Station.
So Waterfront SkyTrain Station, March 20th at 2 p.m.?
That's right.
Okay. And so the how many people are you expecting for this March for the Elimination of Racism?
Well, we're hoping towards 500 people, which is a generous amount of people in Vancouver to come out to marches. But we're hoping more, and we're hoping more people will join as we march through the streets.
Wonderful. And so, obviously, the elimination of racism is the main thing that you're hoping to accomplish. But what are you, I mean, that's such a huge thing to accomplish. So on March 20th, what are you hoping to accomplish?
We have four demands for March 20th. And, you know, obviously, these are just broken down into, like, sort of like you said, digestible sort of. And racism seems really big, but definitely an end to individual and institutional racism, whether it be individual in the form of hate crimes or remarks, but also policies, like racist policies in the form of immigration policies that are very repressive and violent towards immigrants and refugees, as well as the theft of indigenous land by resource-hungry corporations. So another one of our demands is to defend indigenous communities and stop theft of indigenous land. Another one of our demands is freedom from police violence and imprisonment and deportation. We find that over racialized people are overrepresented in terms of police violence, and also thousands of people are deported every year from Canada. And our final demand is living wages, health care, education, and housing for all. About a quarter of recent immigrants in Canada are, you know, take low-paying jobs and live in poverty. So those are some of our demands, and we hope that that you will come and join us for the march.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. So again, that is March 20th, which is a Sunday. Sunday, March 20th, 2 p.m. It's going to start at the Waterfront SkyTrain station. So is that outside the terminal there in Gastown?
Yeah, that's right. Just right there on Cordova Street, right in front of the station.
Perfect. Yeah, March 20th.
For any more information, just noonelegal.org.
Noonelegal.org. Thank you so much, Suzanne.
Thank you, Marie.
Have a great day. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Okay. So again, that is Sunday, March 20th, and that is the March for the Elimination of Racism. If you'd like to take part in that, meet them at the front of Waterfront Station in Gastown at 2 p.m. So thank you again to Suzanne for that. And so today we are speaking with Michael Clarkson. He is the author of The Poltergeist Phenomenon, an in-depth investigation into floating beds, smashing glass, and other unexplained disturbances. And we haven't really done much talking about ghosts and the paranormal. We usually talk about fluffy butterflies and things like that. So I'm interested to talk about something a little more sinister on the show today. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Yes, thanks for having me, Marie.
Thanks for being with us. So first of all, you are a journalist. Are you still a journalist, or are you now focusing mainly on books?
Yes, Marie, I was a print reporter for many years, many decades. I took a buyout from the Toronto Star, which is, of course, one of Canada's national papers a few years ago. And since then, I've been focusing on books and professional speaking.
Wonderful. Well, thanks for speaking with us today. So what piqued your interest in this whole spooky poltergeist phenomenon?
Well, it goes back quite a ways. 1970, there was a case in St. Catharines, Ontario, in which police were involved over a two-week period, and they saw some amazing things. They reported some amazing things in their police logs. And I sort of put that on the back burner. I was working in newspapers at the time. 1980, same case, 10 years later, a boy involved in that case came to my house. He told me a number of things, and I started to believe that there may be something to this poltergeist phenomena. But I still kept it on the back burner and kept collecting other stories involving poltergeists through the years, and finally I sat down and wrote a book about it.
Wonderful. So there are a few different theories on what a poltergeist is. Some people think it's a ghost, a mischievous ghost that causes trouble but doesn't usually harm people, and other people think that it's the teenager's ability. Maybe they have some kind of telekinesis or something like that, and they're the ones that are causing all these disturbances.
Yes, there are a number of descriptions depending on who you talk to, Marie, but after reviewing 75 cases of poltergeist, I've come to the conclusion that they seem to be haunted people rather than haunted homes or spirits involved, although I do have a section in my book, a chapter on ghosts. It's hard to prove that poltergeist actually exists, but after talking to many police officers, in fact, there have been 51 police officers in 17 cases over the years who claim they saw or heard poltergeist activity. Now, and that led me, one of the reasons I did this book, because I am a skeptical investigative reporter. When the police say something, they seem to have a lot to lose, so when they talk, I usually listen. However, getting back to your question, the haunted people, there's a term, recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis. The term is RSPK for short, and that was coined by a parapsychologist who is now living in Georgia. His name is William Rohl. He's a foremost expert in poltergeist. He believes that they're haunted people. He believes, as I do after reviewing all these cases, most of the poltergeist cases seem to revolve around the young person, sometimes entering puberty, and usually he or she is quite intelligent. Another trend or another circumstance which seems to be through these cases is that there's usually some sort of repression or frustration of the poltergeist agent by others, and a high level of stress in the household prior to the start of this activity and continuing throughout the case. I must get back to that original question, though. The poltergeist dynamics are that there are usually dramatic events such as unexplained knocking, electrical malfunctions, and movements of objects and furniture. Occasionally reported, very occasionally, are levitation of objects, electrical appliances working without power, and stones apparently falling from nowhere. Another trend going through these cases seems to be a short lifespan of 1 week, perhaps, to several months. They don't usually last long. That's why it makes it hard for investigators to come to a lot of conclusions about the poltergeist mysteries. And finally, there's usually not a mischievous intent on the part of the young person or the person around whom the activity is occurring. Rather, I found some people who were injured. In fact, I think there was a dozen cases in my book where people were injured, but not seriously, by flying cups or flying saucers. Now, there's more to it than that. Obviously, this is complex enough, but I think, Marie, these young people do tap into some sort of local energy nearby to make things happen. I think they seem to have an unusual brain, for one thing. There's a high rate of schizophrenia and epilepsy among the poltergeist agents. But beyond that, I think they tap into whether it's household electricity, geomagnetic storms in the area, or sometimes we forget we have electricity in the beat of our human heart, and people have electricity going through their body. So I think it's a very complex case, and there's a number of components which seem to have to come together. It's almost like a perfect storm or a perfect psychic storm involving these young people. They don't necessarily know they're doing it or how they're doing it, but I think they have no other way, they think, to express themselves in a repressed family situation than to do this. Now, what I've described is in the main of these 75 cases. I do have some cases which seem to involve spirits. We can talk about that now or later.
Okay, well, I mean, when you say, Michael, that it's a haunted person, one would assume haunted by a spirit, but it sounds like you're saying maybe they're just haunted by troubles or stress.
Yes. A number of things, yes, that would be the number one thing. They may be troubled teenagers to begin with. They may have some emotional problems to begin with, but obviously poltergeist activity doesn't manifest itself around all teenagers who seem to have emotional problems. But yes, usually it's not spirits, but it's something haunted about the person, perhaps in their family life. And then beyond that, I think they're genetically different. As I say, the unusual brains affecting taking in electricity nearby and affecting gravity and causing gravity to be suspended temporarily.
And so, Michael, also it seems like through reading your book that most of these cases, the paranormal activity doesn't actually last for more than a few weeks to a year, maybe at the most. So it's a temporary situation. And so what do you see with these kids after whatever it is passes? Are they different people? Are they more grounded? Are they less stressed? Or are they still the same people they were before the poltergeist activity?
Yes, good question, Marie. Most of the time after the poltergeist activity or RSPK dissipates, the child seems to return to a so-called normal life, and we don't hear anything more about them. In fact, I don't think a lot of follow-ups have been done. There may be some of the so-called normal poltergeist cases, but the follow-ups are not being done. But I suspect that most of these young people, it dissipates and it's gone. However, there are exceptions, and there are exceptions to the age groups. I'm now interviewing a woman in Canada. I can't say what city. She doesn't want to be identified, but she's in her mid-40s, and the poltergeist activity has followed her through the years. There are several cases in my book of that where the poltergeist activity, or RSPK, actually is turned into a cousin of that energy, which is called psychokinesis. I think most of your listeners will be able to relate to that a little more. Psychokinesis is PK for short, and it is moving things more consciously with your mind. Again, there's no proof that it exists. We have some tests, and mainstream science does not seem to accept that. However, there are some people, it seems, to answer your question again, they move through puberty. We don't see it much anymore, but later on in life sometimes they can either, it happens again, or they learn how to maneuver things. This lady in Canada, Eastern Canada, she has had poltergeist activity when, even up to today, when she is upset by her husband, things seem to move around. Heavy appliances have even moved around, cups and saucers. Now, she has been able to, she tells me, to turn that into PK by focusing. She thinks the poltergeist energy is very negative. She doesn't like it. She's taken drugs, a number of things to try to reduce it. But what works for her, it seems now, is she's made this little pinwheel, and it's made of a pencil, simple little homemade pinwheel with a wheel made of paper on top, and she focuses on this pinwheel intently and claims to make it move. She gave me a demonstration on Skype not long ago, and yes, voila, there it was. I watched the pinwheel move around back and forth for 20 minutes. Now, I can't prove that she didn't have some sort of a wire attached, but I'm pretty skeptical, and I was fairly impressed with that. So the problem in this whole thing is when we talk about testing, when we talk about research, there's this large stigma involved with not only the paranormal, but poltergeist in particular. That's why I can't use this woman's name. That's why I still, to this day, 40 years later, can't use the name of that boy in the 1970 case in St. Catharines, because mainstream media, the mainstream science, and the mainstream public tend not to believe so much in the paranormal.
And so he's afraid of the stigma that he would deal with. And in your book, you actually, when he came to your house in 1980, that Halloween night, you had published something in the newspaper about his story that day, and he had been being pranked. Someone put a ghost in his locker at work and things like that.
Well, I'm glad you read my book. Yes, yeah. Right on top of the thing. Do you want me to go through that case a little bit?
Sure. I think it's time for a break. So when we're back from the break, let's go through that case. We are speaking right now with Michael Clarkson. He is the author of The Poltergeist Phenomenon, an in-depth investigation into floating beds, smashing glass, and other unexplained disturbances. We'll be back with more synchronicity in just a moment.
March 18th, the year 2011, is Drop-In, Drop-Out Video Arts Expo at W2 Storium. Projected video work from over 30 Vancouver artists. 31,000 square feet of interactive art. Out of this universe. Musical accompaniment by Channels 3 and 4, Animal Bodies, Magnetic Ring, Holtzkopf, and Crystal Dorval. After hours featuring Jason Lev, Love, Dancing, and more. Hallucinations provided by dropoutvideo.com and byobworldwide.com. Admission by donation before 10 p.m.
Oh, and speaking about donations, if you are at the University of British Columbia campus today and you need a new do, they are doing cuts for cancer at the Student Union building. I don't know what kind of lineup there is, but you can go get your haircut, and the proceeds are going to cancer research. So if you need a haircut, stop by the Student Union building today for Cuts for Cancer. So this is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You're listening to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and you might also be listening online at CITR.ca, CosmicDimensions.com, EmpowerRadio.com, or on the Co-Creator Network. So wherever you're listening from, thanks so much for joining us today for a little bit of a more spooky episode. Usually we talk about things like love and feeling good and everything, but this is kind of scary. And I have to admit, I was reading this book before bed and reading the accounts of these poltergeist situations, and it was pretty scary. I had to put the book down because I thought, oh no, I don't want to have dreams about poltergeists. But we'll talk more about that. We're going to talk with the author, Michael Clarkson, about that case in St. Catharines, Ontario, right now. Welcome back to the show, Michael.
Yes, thanks, Marie.
So this young man, explain to us what happened. It was quite a freaky-deaky case.
Sure. It's typical, however, of these seemingly these rare poltergeist cases. In 1970, this 11-year-old boy lived with his family, both parents and a younger brother, in St. Catharines, in a small apartment above a store. And it was said to be a typical European-style family where the children were to be seen and not heard. So I think the boy felt he was suppressed or repressed, and strange things started happening. Over a two-week period, there were things like paintings would fall off the wall, heavy chairs and even beds would move up in the air very briefly and come down. The family was very upset about this. They contacted they thought there was something wrong with the building at first. They contacted the building inspectors and the hydro people, fire department even, but found nothing. That was the last resort. They brought the police in because things were moving around. They were afraid of somebody getting injured. Now, I knew these police officers, and over a two-week period, an entire shift of officers swear they saw these things which I've just described. In fact, I've got a couple of reports here I can read right off their logs. February 7th, Constable Robert Crawford found a heavy bed had reportedly been raised 2 feet off the floor by an unseen force. It was reported by a Mrs. Baines, a neighbor, who told police she had seen it rise off the floor in the boy's bedroom. Crawford said he rushed into the room and saw the bed approximately 2 feet off the floor, unsupported at one end. He said, not believing my eyes, I summoned other officers. 3 days later, February 10th, for about the 12th time in almost 2 weeks, Constable Bill Weir said he saw John Mulvey, as a pseudonym I've given this boy, he saw John Mulvey thrown off a chair by an unknown force. Weir wrote, quote, I attended in the morning and was assisted by Constable Eddie Batorski. While I was there, I witnessed some phenomenal occurrences which I have attached to this report. At 9 p.m., I proceeded to the residence again with Constable Crawford, where we again witnessed some very unusual things. Between the time of the two calls, I contacted Mr. Bradley, the city building inspector. We both agreed that the causes of these weird occurrences was that the boy was the center of poltergeist activity. Now, Weir's report was later signed and authorized by his commanding officer, Sergeant Buck Taylor. Weir said, however, and he didn't say on his report, but he told another officer, who I believe, Weir said he himself got the treatment from this unseen force. He told Fox that the force picked up a chair that Weir was sitting in. Now, Weir was about a 200-pound man. The poltergeist force picked up a chair he was sitting in and, according to Weir, tipped him on his ass. Now, if this little 11-year-old boy, maybe 70 pounds soaking wet, had really done that physically, Marie, I think that would be a tough one to explain to the boys back at the station. Really pop, overpowered by an 11-year-old. You did mention he came to my home. 10 years later, I did an anniversary story without naming him because he was never named. And he still was repressed, he said, in his family. 10 years later, he was still not allowed to talk about that case. And when my anniversary story appeared that night, Halloween night, 1980, his father got very upset, and I think he pulled the plug, the phone out of the wall, and the young boy, John Mulvey, he was 21 years old now, he had to leave the house. He didn't know anywhere else to go, so he phoned me. I had talked to him a week earlier to do the anniversary story. And ironically, he was the only visitor we had at Halloween that year, which makes it quite spooky. In fact, I had to talk my wife into letting him come. But when he did come, he told me some things indirectly about the case, but mostly he was very worried about people finding out who he was because he had a very good job working with young people. And he was worried that if the parents of the young people found out that he was linked to this case years earlier, they would pull their kids out of the program. And he said he thought about telling a story publicly, but he said everything today was for a buck and it's not worth the price on my personal life. Now, he didn't give direct details of the 1970 occurrences, although he said he remembered them well. I remember him telling me he was very intelligent. He could read when he was five, which goes, again, with part of that criteria I mentioned. They're usually above average in intelligence. He said the papers at the time in 1970 didn't get the story right. The papers at the time were talking about being spirit-related or perhaps possession. And John Mulvey said the papers were guessing. Since then, he said, I've done some reading, some investigating of my own, and I have my own theories. But again, he didn't want to have his name used, so he's been mentioned a number of times with pseudonyms over the years. But I think that case is as good as it gets as far as eyewitness reports. There have been some other more highly publicized cases around the world, but there seems to be holes in some of the cases, and no one has come forward in the 40 years since this happened to say John Mulvey cheated. And again, the police officers all involved, I mean, police have so much to lose if they write up a report about a poltergeist, for goodness sakes, they go back to the police station and their credibility is on the line. Plus the fact, Marie, that I find police officers, and I was a cop reporter for 13 years, police tend to be solid witnesses. They're usually trained and experienced in knowing how to focus when something like this is happening fast. and they're very skeptical and cynical. So they were watching this 11-year-old boy very closely because he was always in the room when these things occurred. He became a suspect, but they didn't see anything, any magic. They didn't see him pull anything down. And so I think this case is quite solid. In fact, it got in the papers and it got onto Johnny Carson's show as a joke at the time.
Interesting. So, it sounds, when I was reading all the police statements, it does, they do, cops tend to be pretty skeptical. And of course, there is that whole ego thing. They're not going to embarrass themselves with the rest of the force by saying they got spooked by a ghost if nothing really happened, or if it's something, if they made it up in their head, they're not going to talk openly about it.
Sure. Yeah, that's another good point. Their ego, very macho business, still is to this day. And yes, they would look very vulnerable if they weren't right on this case.
Mm-hmm. So it must, even if they did see these things and experience them, the fact that they came forward and admitted that they saw that is actually quite impressive, because that would take a lot of guts.
Yes, I tried to get this case through to the Amazing Randy. Have you heard of the Amazing Randy? He's a magician / skeptic. He goes around looking at these cases and seeing if there's anything to them. He offers $1 million if someone can actually prove there's paranormal occurrences. But I tried to explain to him that, can you please look at this case? And no, he just dismissed it outright. If he hadn't seen it, like a lot of skeptics, if he doesn't see it happen, then it never happened. I'm sort of like that, Marie. I've, as I say, I was a police reporter many years, and I've seen all kinds of things. People were always trying to sell me things. So I don't put my name very lightly on something like this unless I believe it's at least very suggestive in its evidence. In fact, I've already taken a hit. My credibility's taken a little bit of a hit. I had another book came out in the past year about the pianist Glenn Gould, about his secret love life. And one of the reviewers of that book, National Post, insinuated that what credibility could I have, because I was working on a book about poltergeists. So you can see it's a bit of a risk, but I think it was worth it.
Interesting. And so I'm curious, Michael, why do you think, you've already said that people don't tend to really be open to belief in the paranormal, but why do you think that there is such an incredible stigma? And that's part of the reason why it's so difficult to research these poltergeist cases, because people are afraid to come forward. Why do you think that is?
It's just that people don't want to be ridiculed, and partly it's that. With science, it's that they really need 100% proof to go on to the next level in something, usually. So scientists, when a case like this comes up, the media will get involved and they'll tend to prop up a talking head, perhaps a scientist, and the scientists will probably debunk it because there is no real proof that poltergeists exist. So you're right, then that tends to make it hard to research. In fact, the stigma has not only hurt someone like me, it's hurt scientists. Some scientists who have tried to investigate this. There's a very respected neuroscientist at Laurentian University in Ontario by the name of Dr. Michael Persinger. Now, his name will come up again if we talk for much longer, because he's involved in some of these cases. But he told me that when he started investigating this type of phenomena, he started to lose government grants. So as you can see, people think it's hokey. Some people think it's hokey. Some people don't want to be ridiculed. And mainstream science, if they don't have it in a lab, if it's not on video, then it didn't happen.
And so, it's interesting that he would lose government grants, because even though it seems kind of hokey, it is something that happens, whether it's really a poltergeist or whether it's some other kind of misbehavior by a kid or whatever. But do you think it's maybe because it is still, it's quite rare?
Yes. I don't think people, I'm using all these police, 51 police officers in 17 cases. I don't think people are aware of that angle. If you told your average listener about poltergeists, I think he or she would suspect it had something to do with ghosts, something to do with possession, and those things are not really accepted yet, I don't think, in mainstream society. But if they read my book, I think, with an open mind, I think Yes, it would be. It would. They would tend to believe it more, I would say. But so far, I just don't think people believe. When you mention the word poltergeist, they just don't believe it exists in general. There are some people who believe in everything, of course. You know, UFOs, ghosts, and Bigfoot, and poltergeist all together. Sometimes that hurts because I think we're dealing here with. I'm not going to debunk the paranormal in general, but I think we're dealing here with something which is super-natural. I think it's coming partly from our fight-or-flight system, which affects the mind many times. And as I said, there's many other components involved. The young people, the suspension of gravity, the perfect psychic storm.
So I want to talk, because when we talk about poltergeist, the first thing I think about are horror movies. Of course, there's the poltergeist movies. But then what about, like, we talk about telekinesis in the movie Carrie. She had telekinesis, and when she got stressed out, she slammed all the doors and burned down the gymnasium. And well, I hope I'm not spoiling the movie if anyone hasn't seen it. So she had that telekinetic ability. And then what about in a movie like The Exorcist, where there was levitation, there was projectile vomiting, there was all of that? I mean, was that a poltergeist phenomenon in your opinion, or was that more of, what do you think that was?
I think that was screenwriters. That's another reason I think people are skeptical about poltergeist, is they take the Hollywood version. Yes, those are good examples you gave there. Another example, of course, was the movie by the name, title of Poltergeist, and a series of movies by Poltergeist. But these are Hollywood manifestations of writers' minds. They're entertaining. That's why we go to watch horror movies. Not for science, I don't think, but we go to watch, and we want to be entertained. We want the chills to go up and down our spine, and it's a little bit out of the ordinary. But if you look at all these movies, none of them were based on real stories. In fact, maybe some of them may have been partly based on parts of cases, but, for example, the movie Poltergeist, the original one, if I recall, the dynamic was that there was a TV involved, the young girl was going in the TV, all kinds of crazy things were happening, and caused by spirits of the dead, which the house was on an Indian burial site. So this was a many-layered entertainment deal with Hollywood, and really has nothing to do with the facts.
Okay. All I can remember is that lady that said, Carol Ann, and she was so scary.
Yeah. Great movie. I liked it.
But not really quite what your book is about. You take a very, we can't say scientific, because it's really hard to scientifically research this, but you look really closely at whatever seems to be the facts in the case.
Sure. I can go, Marie, if you've got a moment, I can go through the testing which has been done on these people.
Definitely, yes.
Sure. As I said, there's no conclusive evidence that poltergeist, RSPK, or even psychokinesis or telekinesis, as you mentioned earlier, exists. But possibly the most compelling evidence was a woman in Russia in the 1950s and 60s. And for your readers, your listeners, they can perhaps YouTube her and get some videos of her. Her name was Nina Kulagina, Kulagina. Initially, she had poltergeist activity, reportedly, in her apartment in Russia, and the Soviet scientists believed it so much that they got involved, and for over three decades, they tested this woman, including two Nobel laureates were testing her. They had her in often closely controlled conditions in the lab, and they claimed she could move things by focusing tightly with her mind. Sometimes Nina was put into a cage to prevent trickery, or she was forced to move things placed in a plexiglass cube with video cameras rolling. And what makes this case so unique is that no one ever caught her cheating. Now, there's been some other tests in the United States. There was a laboratory at Princeton University which ran for a few years, and it was run by a professor by the name of Robert John, J-A-H-N. He believed that he and his colleagues at Princeton produced good experimental data to support the existence of psychokinesis. They said that some people had been able to influence small balls and pendulums through the force of their mind. But again, not good enough for mainstream science to accept, but at the very least, it's suggestive.
Wonderful. Thank you for clearing that up. And it's freaking me out. It's time to take a break. So we are speaking with Michael Clarkson. He is the author of The Poltergeist Phenomenon, an in-depth investigation into floating beds, smashing glass, and other unexplained disturbances. We will be back with more synchronicity in a flash.
Listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Turn on your radio, turn on your radio, turn on your radio, turn on your radio, turn on your radio.
Welcome back to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I am your host, Marie Bernard. Thanks for being with us today. And over the last few days, we've been looking a lot at what's going on in Japan. Of course, they had that catastrophic earthquake and tsunami and crazy aftershocks, and now they're dealing with the nuclear reactors and all of that. So if you're concerned about Japan, I would just ask you to send your love and good thoughts and whatever you can afford to give, of course, to relief efforts, and send it with an intention of speedy cleanup, of safety, of reconnection with families and loved ones for the beautiful country of Japan. So please do send them some love and whatever else you're able to give to those people. So right now we are speaking with Michael Clarkson. He is the author of The Poltergeist Phenomenon, an in-depth investigation into floating beds, smashing glass, and other unexplained disturbances. Welcome back to the show, Michael.
Yes, thank you, Marie.
So some people, there are people who research this stuff, and they're called parapsychologists?
Yes.
But what about the people who are working at Princeton and Harvard and the neurologist, or who was he, a neuroscientist?
Dr. Persinger at Laurentian University, yes.
Yes, so did they call themselves parapsychologists as well?
Dr. Persinger doesn't. He's a neuroscientist. And now one of the problems with poltergeist activity is that there are fewer parapsychologists lately who are studying this. I mentioned a William Roll earlier from Georgia. He's semi-retired, and he's the foremost expert in poltergeist. And he's looked at several hundred cases over the years, but no one seems to be taking up the mantle as far as poltergeist research goes. Dr. Persinger, he goes off in different areas. He is actually skeptical of many paranormal events. He created a few years ago something called the God Helmet. He puts this helmet on people in his laboratory, and it emits some electronic signals. And he says that people with his helmet on have a much higher rate of seeing things, hallucinating, seeing UFOs, reporting an entity, God. They come out of the cell saying they've seen God or they felt God in their presence. So he is he's fairly skeptical. So when he talks about this woman in Canada, who I mentioned earlier, Sarah, I call her in the book, he thinks that she has some amazing abilities. Then he's got more credibility. But I think one area we should be looking at, Marie, a little more closely, if we want to get at the bottom of something like this, is the area of fear. And you asked initially how I got involved in this book. Another reason I got involved in this book is I've written a number of books on fear over the years, and I was embarrassed to find out how little I knew about my own life and how fear interacted with it. When I started researching this book, I found out things like, and your listeners can probably relate to this more than they can poltergeist activity, the average person has 66,000 thoughts a day, and 44,000 of these are negative thoughts. As soon as I heard that, that really changed my life. I thought, oh my goodness, what have I been doing all this time? And I'm not aware of this fact. And other simple things like all stress, I believe, the stress we feel in our lives is called fear energy. It's simply a manifestation, an activation of our fight-or-flight system. Every one of your listeners has a fight-or-flight system. It's hardwired into us from millions of years back, and it still has the same response when we feel challenges. It was good in the old days for mastodons and physical challenges when we were fighting each other and we lived outdoors. And it's not so good these days because our challenges are more social and professional. So our fight-or-flight system, though, keeps kicking in when you're talking maybe to your boss or someone on the phone you're not pleased with. You may get tension in your shoulders, and there's only one reason for that is your fight-or-flight system has kicked in to help you fight or run away. Now, some people have been able to adapt that to the modern challenges, and they are the high achievers of our society. They've been able to reroute their fear into high achievement. Now, the link between this, if there is a link between this, and poltergeist activity is a mental one and mental powers. In my life and my career as a journalist and an amateur athlete, I think I've been able to get into the so-called zone 35 to 40 times by using my mental abilities to trigger my hormones and my fight-or-flight system. In other words, if I'm choking under pressure, which I've done from time to time, on deadline pressure, and I feel myself choking, what I say to them, I get myself angry because it usually floods your body with adrenaline when you're choking. And it's not that great of a, it's a, really an overworked cliche that adrenaline is everything. What you need in your system is a more proactive mix of hormones. So when I got angry briefly, then it changes my hormonal chemistry to not only adrenaline, but more aggressive hormones like testosterone and dopamine. Now, I know your female listeners probably don't want to hear much about testosterone, but actually testosterone levels are going up in women these days because they're taking on jobs which men had before, and there's more pressure, more challenges. Testosterone can help us if we focus. But the third part of this equation is changing this too much adrenaline into more proactive hormones in your mind and in your body. The third part of this is dispassionate response. You have this extra power, but you've got to plug it into whatever it is you're doing, whether it's me when I'm typing and interviewing for deadline, or it's me when I'm playing basketball in a crisis situation, in a game pressure situation. I've had a number of weird things happen mentally. Two games I had the same thing. I saw the ball leave my hand a quarter of a second before it did, and then the ball, real ball went, and the same thing happened when it reached the basket. A quarter of a second before it did, went in, and the real ball went in. Now, I think this was part of my fight-or-flight system. I didn't miss any of those shots those days, but I wasn't thinking about it, and I didn't think about it until 2 or 3 days later. I thought, my goodness, what happened? Try to go backwards and see what happened. Well, there was a number of things involved, and to make a long story short, I was always challenged by this one player who was covering me. It happened in both games, and I felt my ego was at stake, and so my fight-or-flight system kicked in, but I was able to redirect this energy into my shooting and my basketball playing, which I have done also, as I said, in my work. I think your listeners may be able to relate to this in some way. Usually once in your life you have a real physical crisis, an automobile accident, perhaps a drowning or something happening, and you seem to have more powers. You hear about these stories occasionally of little old ladies picking up the car off their mm-hmm. Dying grandchild because they have the surge of energy. And that's the typical fight or flight. Sometimes I talk to accident victims who've been in a car rolling over, and they see the ashtray moving in slow motion. Again, part of fight or flight, giving us seemingly more time to react to something. You're seeing the action one frame at a time. That's called tachypsyche. That's part of the fight or flight system. I think it's nature's way of helping us get out of threatening situations, as it seems to slow down the action. Now, there seems to be quite a leap, of course, between what I've just described, which is use of fear energy, and the poltergeist manifestation of mind over matter. But an argument could be made, Marie, that the greatest of the greats, including someone like Tiger Woods, let's use him as an example in golf when he was in his prime, there's an argument to be made that not only did he have training and skill, but during pressure putts, he actually willed that ball into the hole. Now, we can't test that, but I suspect that may be at play as well. So I think sometimes we underestimate the incredible capabilities we have, but most of the time we let fear not work for us. Most of the time, fear works against us. Most of the time, stress works against us. And people tend not to take chances in their lives. They tend to not meet their dreams because they're too worried, usually, about fear. They're worried about what people think. So, in general, I'm not downplaying fear. It is usually a negative force, but you can make fear work for yourself. And if they read this little, there's a little section on that in this book about poltergeist, and some of my earlier books are about directly about fear.
And so, Michael, when we're talking about a case like Tiger Woods willing the ball into the hole, what, I mean, we've talked about the adrenaline and the testosterone and all of that, but what is your theory on what exactly they're tapping into that is creating this theoretical telekinetic
yes.
phenomenon?
Now, you're talking about, the telekinetic, it's really, I think it... We can't even prove either exists, but what I think they're tapping into, Marie, is, again, as I said, it's called tachypsychia. It's Greek for speed of the mind. Usually it's a case of you're under pressure and you see things happening in slow motion, like video camera going fast, but it actually seems to be slow. Now, they don't know how they do it. In fact, I interviewed Tiger Woods about this one time. But what he's tapping into is tachypsychia. Sometimes it doesn't slow things down. Sometimes it makes the hole look bigger. In fact, when I've been playing basketball, the basket looked bigger when I was in these rare occurrences. And other players, Michael Jordan, another one, he told me the same thing. On some nights, that basketball looks bigger. It could be that, again, the number of components are at play as they are in the Poltergeist Kids. Number one, it's a big game. Michael Jordan, if he was a mediocre game where he didn't get up for the game, I doubt if fight or flight or tachypsychia would kick in. Very important game. He feels challenged. In fact, Michael Jordan used to intentionally get himself worked up during a game. I covered the NBA for a few years, and he would trash talk other opponents, saying terrible things like, you know, I'm Michael Jordan. You're trying to cover me? But he knew that would make the other person try harder, and that would give Michael Jordan a challenge, and Michael Jordan's fight-or-flight system would kick in, and he would use it, and he would know that we are different people chemically under pressure than we are without pressure. These hormones act as an additive to our skills. And Tiger Woods actually gave me a bit of a clue that he knew what was going on to a point. I asked him once, how often, Tiger, do you get nervous on a golf course? And his answer was very surprising. He said he got nervous before every shot. Now, most athletes they would never admit that. Most athletes don't want to admit they're afraid, but the ones who do, I think the ones who are aware, have more of a chance of getting in the zone than ones who don't. Just to use golf as an example, what Tiger would do is, when he was nervous before a shot, it would depend on what kind of a shot he was taking. In golf, we have different skills. When he needed a long wood shot, a 200, 300-yard shot, you can use power, so actually fight or flight, The blood going to your big muscles to fight a runaway can help you. And so he would get pumped up for a long shot. Now, when he got on the green, it's more of a touch situation, more of a mental situation, and he would try to bring himself down. He would have relaxation techniques. So I think he was aware of his fight-or-flight system and what it could do for him.
That sounds like you need to talk with the Canucks, because whenever they get close to the, close to the cup, they choke. I think they need to take advantage of that fight or flight.
It gets more complex, Omri, when we're dealing with more than one person.
Oh, okay.
In fact, it's quite rare even with one person if you don't know what you're doing. But with an entire team, although there are things like chemistry, there's not only a social network among hockey players, but there seems to be sometimes an emotional chemistry during games. So I think there's some link, but it's not a direct one.
So it sounds like in the case of like Tiger Woods and athletes, it's not quite the same phenomenon as the poltergeist situation. It's more of a how your brain is perceiving what you're looking at. Like the hole will appear bigger. Time seems to slow down.
Yes, but what I'm saying is that if we're not getting too far on the poltergeist research, I think we should start seeing it perhaps through another lens, and that lens is fear. And through that lens of fear, we see fight or flight. We see these amazing mental things happen from time to time. And that obviously is one of the major components that I told you earlier about poltergeist activity, is that there is stress, there is fear, sometimes there's even anger going on in those homes. So it's obvious to me that the fight or flight system of the young person is being activated. Now, they're activating a part of their brain which most of us can do, but again, there's other components involved, the unusual brains perhaps, the unusual way that they can tap into local electricity.
Wonderful. Well, it's time for another break. So we are speaking with Michael Clarkson. He is the author of The Poltergeist Phenomenon, an in-depth investigation into floating beds, smashing glass, and other unexplained disturbances. Coming up in just a few minutes is Parts Unknown. So stick around for that coming up at 1 p.m. This is Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul here on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Welcome back to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. Thanks so much for being with us today. We are speaking with Michael Clarkson, the author of The Poltergeist Phenomenon, an in-depth investigation into floating beds, smashing glass, and other unexplained disturbances. Welcome back to the show, Michael.
Yes, pleasure to be with you.
So where can people pick up your book?
At Chapters or Amazon.com in the United States, Barnes & Noble. Or they could reach me directly, michael.paul.clarkson@gmail.com.
Great. And do you have a website where you're keeping up with more information as it comes in?
Yes and no. I have a website, but it's not updated. People can go to my website, www.michaelclarkson.com, and see things about my speaking about fear and stress. I'm in the middle of updating it. That's why I gave you my current email address.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. So we just have a few minutes left in the show before Parts Unknown comes on. So I'm wondering, is there anything that's really important that we haven't talked about yet?
We got how many minutes? We got about 6-7 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, for your listeners who believe in ghosts, I should refer to a few cases in my book. There are still some people. There's a Virginia psychiatrist by the name of Dr. Ian Stevenson. Now, he believes there's a link between spirits of the dead and poltergeist activity, and he sometimes suggests to victimized families that a seance be held to cleanse a home. Others believe that a poltergeist agent is possessed by a spirit or demon, and they sometimes suggest a type of exorcism to try to bring the person back to himself or herself. Now, William Rowe, the parapsychologist from Georgia, after researching these hundreds and hundreds of cases, he does not know of any case in which a spirit was responsible for a poltergeist incident. However, he said we should not close our minds to that possibility, but they always seem to occur around a living person. And if we're finishing off your show anytime soon, Marie, I've got a section in my book about help for the victims. Now, you talk about you have love on your show quite a bit, and that would refer to this would refer to love and help for the victims and counseling. Do you want me to read that section of the book?
Yes, please.
It would take probably 3-4 minutes.
Thank you.
Sure. It's entitled Help for the Victims. How do you get rid of an alleged poltergeist? Most cases of RSPK seem to die a natural death after a few weeks or months, and sometimes it eases with the easing of stress in a household. Sometimes the occurrences end when the agent realizes he or she is the cause. Other times, psychotherapy seems to help. Exorcisms in general don't seem to work, but clergy and parapsychologists report some relief to the victims when they counsel the family. If the stress in a family is addressed, paranormal activity will often disappear, according to Alan Murdy. He's the chairman of England's Ghost Club Society. In poltergeist cases, he said, buildings are not haunted, people are. So as you see here, we've got the president of the Ghost Club who thinks it's got to do with it, people and their unusual brains. Also, another point in help for the victims, people who call up Maurice Gross. Now, he is a parapsychologist in England. He said that people who call him up are very upset about what's happening. He reassures them that they won't be damaged by this poltergeist force, and sometimes this helps them. He said, our role is partly being a social worker. Gross advised people not to move out of their homes when this activity occurs because the activity will likely be dragged along with them. I have a few cases in my book where poltergeist activities actually followed the family. Now, Stephen Mera, a parapsychologist in Manchester, England, he does not claim to be able to get rid of poltergeists, but what he says is, most of all, our investigations help the family through the crisis, give them information, support, and assistance, and we try to identify what is causing the occurrences. In a case in Baltimore, a parapsychologist by the name of Nathan Fedor suggested that a suspected poltergeist agent, a young boy, receive encouragement for his writing talent, which he was frustrated over. Apparently, this boy felt repressed creatively in the family. Now, the family agreed with this parapsychologist, and they gave the young boy, finally gave him praise and credit for his work. And not long after that, the disturbances ended. Now, some of these youthful poltergeist agents pull out of their problems, others do not. William Roll said, some of them go on to normal lives. However, some have psychological problems to begin with. When the phenomena stops, the problems continue. In fact, there was a case in Columbus, Ohio in 1984 where a 14-year-old girl allegedly had legitimate poltergeist activity going on, but when it dissipated and she grew into a young woman, the problems from her childhood increased, and she was actually convicted of killing her young baby daughter, and she's sadly in jail in Georgia for that now. But to try to finish off with a positive note, there's a psychologist by the name of Dr. John Layard, L-A-Y-A-R-D, and he said, as strange as it sounds, a poltergeist case can be good for relieving tension in an unusual family situation. He said that poltergeists are not chance phenomena, but have a definite purpose. It is a curative one, having for its object the resolution of psychological conflict. Often the poltergeist agent has no other way to relieve the unusual buildup of frustration or tension, whether it is psychological or sexual. Now, I that word would be the elephant in the room, sexual. I have not mentioned one small part of this case, is that many of these young people going, these adolescents are going through puberty, and some parapsychologists believe there is a link between puberty and the pineal gland, which is responsible for controlling the release of sexual hormones. Apparently, that's activated during puberty. And a number of these poltergeist agents, the young people, seem to tap into this somehow, this gland's work and the type of creative energy. Now, we can't prove that again, but there seems to be a number of cases where puberty is involved. So I didn't want to leave that word sexual hanging there.
All right, thanks for that. Well, we just have a couple minutes left before Parts Unknown. Is there anything, Michael, that you would like to add before we close the show?
Yes, there are some cases. We talk about frauds and stigmas involved, but there are some cases where we have frauds and legitimate activity in the same case. Because, Marie, we're dealing with young people often who like attention, and when legitimate poltergeist activity ceases and yet media and parapsychologists are still at the house, they want to have attention, so they'll do things sometimes, like try to pull down a lamp when they think no one is watching, and then they're caught. And then people, skeptics like Amazing Randy, will say, ha-ha, you see, I told you it was suspect all along. But they're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. So I'd say come into these poltergeist cases, come into a book like mine or a show like yours with an open mind.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Michael, for being on the show today. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks. Have a great day. Take care. So that was Michael Clarkson, author of The Poltergeist Phenomenon, an in-depth investigation into floating beds, smashing glass, and other unexplained disturbances. So thanks for being with me today. It's been such a pleasure hanging out with you. I hope that you have a fabulous afternoon and a fabulous week. And remember to please send your loving energy to the people of Japan. They really need it right now. They need to, we've been talking about fear and fear energy. And of course, when we see such catastrophic events, it brings up so many fears for ourselves, especially living in Vancouver, where we have earthquakes all the time. But what we really need right now is to focus on the healing process and to focus on getting things done and creating positive change. So I ask you to take that fear and turn it into love and turn it into something a little bit more constructive. So thanks so much for being with me today. I'm going to close the show with a song by Surya Devi, and coming up next is Parts Unknown. I'm Marie Bernard. Thanks so much for being with me. Have a great day. Bye.